In tracing the history and development of the doctrine of informed consent, it's helpful for us to look at a classical article, one published in 1972 by a famous physician by the name of Engelfinger, who was one of the editors of the New England Journal of Medicine, and who wrote in a variety of areas, both in the area of research medicine, but also in the area of bioethics as well. A very incisive and concise author, he was concerned about some of the difficulties attendant upon the way the doctrine of informed consent had developed and was developing in the early 1970s. It would go on to become even more widely flung than he describes or had seen. His article is still concerned primarily with informed consent in the area of obtaining consent for medical experimentation, but this principle was being more broadly applied even in his day, and the issues that he raises are of significance in any area of attempting to obtain consent for medical procedures. The article is significant in that he points out that in some ways informed consent is an ideal. It is something which one tries to attain, but rather like the mathematical concept of an asymptote, it's never actually achieved. The curve gets closer and closer to it, but it's an almost unachievable goal, and for the reasons that he will describe. Another one that I've mentioned before, but that I'd like to highlight again, is the nature of the physician-patient relationship itself. And before we look at this article, I'd like to share a vignette from my own pastoral experience, and it concerned a young man whom I knew, whose father was dying of cancer. And I've summarized the facts of this in the introduction to Dr. Engelfinger's article. This young man's father was dying of cancer, and he'd been hospitalized at a major medical center. The family knew that there was nothing more that could be done, that the patient was on palliative care, care that was intended to treat his symptoms rather than to improve his health or to return him to health, which they knew was impossible. A researcher at the institution approached the patient and the family and asked permission to give the patient an experimental drug, which was, and they made this very clear, not going to serve the patient by improving his health or making him better. They guaranteed that it would not have any positive effect for the patient, but that the results might be of benefit to patients with similar cancers in the future. This is something that is often said when people are placed on experimental protocols at the end of life or when they have had a round of therapy that has proven to be unsuccessful. The family and the patient agreed. Now, I was speaking to the young man a short time after permission had been given, and as he was explaining this to me, it became clearer and clearer that despite having signed the informed consent, despite having talked to the researcher in detail, the family, and indeed the young man to whom I was speaking, still had some hope that this medication would benefit the patient. And so I asked them, well, didn't they explain this to you? Didn't they tell you that the drug would not actually be of any benefit to him? And the response on the part of this young man, the patient's son, was, yes, father, they told us that the drug wouldn't be of any benefit to my father, that it wouldn't help, but we know that that's what they have to say. We know that that's what doctors are required to say, but... And the implication was that wasn't really the case. And the young man went on to say, we also know that his doctor would never recommend anything that doesn't offer at least some hope of helping him. Now, despite the fact that the informed consent had been crystal clear, and I even saw a copy of what they had signed, and there was no question that they were not concealing anything from the patient, that they were making no claim whatever that this drug would benefit him, the family and the patient were clinging to a hope that was not actually being offered them by their healthcare providers because they trusted the physician-patient relationship, because they wanted to be something that could still will be done for them. And reports of this, similar circumstances, one can even find described in the media, oftentimes in movies, people who realize that they are not going to be helped by a particular therapy, but in clinging to straws, they imagine that an experimental protocol that has been explained to them as being of no benefit, they imagine that nevertheless this potentially might help them in some way. Even people who know better, even medical professionals in this circumstance. So there are contexts in which I have to conclude real informed and fully free consent really is not possible because of the desperate desire on the part of the patient and of the family to believe that there might be something that could be of benefit. And this is one of those settings. Well, Dr. Engelfinger raises related and similar concerns in regard to the whole area of informed consent. And he creates a little scenario, and in doing this, he actually lists all or many of the characteristics that were being strongly emphasized, particularly in the designing of experimental protocols in the early 1970s. And I can attest to the concerns that he raises, having been in the 1970s part of an institutional review board at a major medical center that was charged, this committee was charged with reviewing all of the informed consent protocols that were to be used in any kind of experimental procedures, whatever. And such boards still exist, and their members, which are composed both of medical professionals and also members of the lay public, are specifically charged with making sure that the protocols are as clear as possible, that they are understandable, and that they contain all the relevant and necessary information. But as Dr. Engelfinger points out, this may not be enough. So he says the trouble with informed consent is that it's not educated consent. Let's assume, he says, that the experimental subject, whether a patient, a volunteer, or otherwise enlisted, is exposed to a completely honest array of factual detail. Told, number one, and I've added the numbers here, they're not in Dr. Engelfinger's original article. The patient is told of the medical uncertainty that exists and that must be resolved by research endeavors. They're told the reason for this research project. Number two is informed of the time and discomfort that they personally will experience. Number three, they're informed of the tiny percentage risk of some very serious consequence of the test procedure. And number four is reassured of their rights and given a formal quasi-legal statement to read. And number five, although it's a quasi-legal statement, no exculpatory language is used. That is, one cannot, in having a person signing an informed consent, have the person sign away their rights later to say, I didn't understand, or it wasn't properly explained to me, or I am no longer capable of regarding this as being something inappropriate or wrong. You cannot sign away your rights to a later grievance. So, with his written signature, the subject caps the transaction, and then I've highlighted the text in which Dr. Engelfinger summarizes this. The chances are remote that the subject really understands what he has consented to, in the sense that the responsible medical investigator understands the goals, nature, and hazards of his study. That is, since the patient cannot read the mind of the investigator, since the patient has not gone to medical school or is not themselves involved in the experimental research or protocol, their understanding of all of the depths of this procedure, this recommended experiment, will necessarily be less than the person seeking their consent, and will always be limited, will never be fully informed, fully educated to the degree that one might desire. He goes on to say, the information given to the experimental subject cannot be totally complete. It would be impractical and probably unethical for the investigator to present the nearly endless list of all possible contingencies. Death would probably be a potential side effect in virtually every medical procedure. Some bizarre, strange phenomenon could occur. An infection could be induced, even though this was extremely unlikely. And indeed, one would have to say that, you know, that death is a potential side effect from offering any drug, up to and including something as seemingly ordinary as aspirin. aspirin, which in a very, very tiny, tiny minority of individuals could induce a drug reaction as severe as an aplastic anemia, a condition that can cause complete bone marrow shutdown. So to give all the list of potential side effects is, as the author points out, impractical and probably unethical. And in fact, the investigator may not be aware of every horrible thing that could conceivably happen. So he also points out that other research has demonstrated that, to quote him, comprehension of medical information given to untutored subjects is inversely correlated with the elaborateness of the material presented. To put it differently, the more complicated and elaborate the presentation, the less the subject will actually understand. It has to be put simply, but the more simply you put it, the less comprehensive, the less complete the information will be. And he goes on to state that the facts are that some element of coercion is instrumental in any investigator-subject transaction. There will be some element of coercion, either if it's a research protocol, the patient will be being given money, or will be perhaps told in glowing terms that this is their opportunity to be heroic and to help future individuals. But in fact, a lot of experimental protocols are offered, as the vignette that I described at the beginning of this, out of my own experience, are offered to patients who are sick and who have trusting relationships with their physicians. So as he points out towards the bottom, when informed consent is obtained, it's not the student, the destitute person, or a prisoner to whom, by virtue of their condition, the thumbscrews of coercion are most relentlessly applied. It is the most used and useful of all experimental subjects, the patient with disease. And he concludes rather depressingly in the text that I've highlighted that follows immediately after this: when a man or woman agrees to act as an experimental subject, therefore his or her consent is marked by neither adequate understanding nor total freedom of choice. So there really isn't complete freedom. It's somewhat of an illusory goal. And then finally, at the very end of the article, the section that's highlighted in white and in red text, the subject's only real protection, the public as well as the medical profession must recognize, depends on the conscience and compassion of the investigator and his peers. Now, this is the case for medical experiments, but one needs to expand this to say that the patient's only real protection depends on the conscience and compassion of the physician who is proposing a particular course of action. So, in a way, we are faced again with the problem that was presented at Nuremberg, that patients will trust their physicians, and even if one has all the mechanisms in place of trying to ensure that everything ethical is being done, the patient's confidence in their physician will often override any form that they sign or any things that are said to them in a specific detail, no matter how comprehensive or complete.